I think it would be fair to say that when we read that gospel the first time, without opening it up a little bit, it comes across that Jesus is a little harsh. Some of you would say he's very harsh, and I might be inclined to agree. So it'll be helpful, rather than get sidetracked by what we consider the harshness of Jesus, is to put the conversation into a context that helps make sense for us. The first part of that context is that in the early church, so really just before Matthew had written his gospel and at the time that he was writing his gospel, the big tension amongst the early Christian movement was allowing non-Jews into the Jewish, into the Christian movement to follow Christ. And the tension was, and it even comes through St. Luke's letters in the Acts of the Apostles, the tension was that to allow them to follow Christ, who was a Jew, they should be Jews. And then the argument was, no, they don't have to be Jews, because to be a Jew, for starters, for men, meant that they had to be circumcised. And it also meant for the everyday person that came in, or the non-males, that they have to follow all the Jewish cultic practices. So that it was reached eventually that no, it's not a requirement for a person to follow Christ to be a Jew first. But that took some time. So it's in the context of that background argument, if you like, or tension that was going on, that we have Jesus situated where he is today, talking to the person that he is, and the way that he talks and ignores that person. Let's just dig a little bit deeper. So Jesus has left northern Galilee and he's headed up to the region of Tyre and Sidon, what we would know as Phoenicia originally, up towards the Lebanese border today. Now, that's the Gentile country. So the majority of the population in that part of the world, or that part of Palestine, were non-Jews. Now, Jesus has gone into the non-Jewish territory. That may be because he just wants a break from everything that's happening when he's trying to work with the Jews. His reception is lukewarm, probably at best, with the Jews, and he may well be feeling, well, look, I'm getting nowhere here. I'm going to go and have a breather. So I'm just going to move up north. And he takes with him his disciples. Now, this is in the land of Canaan. Now, the Canaanites, if you read chapter 11 of wisdom literature, you'll really start to discover who they were. Remembering that from Moses got the people to Mount Nebo and then looked across the Jordan River to Jericho, but he never made it. It was Joshua who took them across the Jordan. When they crossed the Jordan, the Israelites in the Exodus, that was the land of Canaan. It was a brutal land. As I said, if you read the wisdom literature, the middle part particularly, they sacrificed babies to pagan gods, for example. That's just one of the examples. They were a very brutal people. So when we talk about being pagan and being Gentile, therefore non-Jew, these people have a very bloodthirsty and nasty heritage. The person who approaches Jesus is a Canaanite woman. In her DNA is all of that, that mixture. So she's not only really a Gentile, a pagan, from the Jewish standpoint, she's hardcore. They're not people that you want to go on holidays with. So that puts her in her place, if you like, in the sense that Jesus has gone away from the first people he came to preach to bring back to God, the Israelites. Now, the Israelites lost 10 of the 12 tribes in 1732. The Assyrians came over, and you've heard me go on about this many times, and most of them were exiled to modern-day Babylon, modern-day Iraq and Syria, and then eventually they came back in the 500s. Now, when the Assyrians conquered, they destroyed 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel. The only two tribes that remained were Judah and Benjamin, the two southern tribes. The 10 tribes that were lost were the ones up north. So when Jesus says, I've come to save the lost tribes or the lost children of Israel, that's who he's referring to. He is referring to getting back, originally, the 10 tribes that were lost. And then they would recognise him as the Messiah because he united the kingdom. However, that's a little bit of the backstory. So this woman comes forward with her DNA, as I say, her history, and then she says those famous words, which are translated right into the beginning of our Mass. In the original Greek, translation's a little different in what you've just heard, but in the original Greek, it is eleison me Kyrie. It's where we get the Kyrie eleison from. Lord, have mercy. They're her opening lines. Lord, have mercy. It's beautiful. It really is. She's a foreigner. She is almost an untouchable. And she comes through and calls him Lord. He's been down with the Jewish people, and they don't call him Lord. They don't recognise him. This woman is there, and she just says, Lord, have mercy. Eleison Kyrie. And he ignores her. We've all been there. The times we put our prayers out there and felt that we've been ignored. But he ignores her. And it's the disciples who then come in and say to him, I'll tell her to shut up, she's driving us mad. We've all been there. Now, the thing is that Jesus then responds to her, because she says to him again, Lord or Master, my daughter is gravely ill, she's possessed. And then Jesus says, well, I've come to reunite the 10 tribes. I've come to bring Israel back together. And that's where I start. And then he goes one step further, which is starting to sound pretty awful. And he says, it's not fair that I should come to unite these people, and I've got to give them first the food off the table, the blessed table, the graced table. They have to receive this first. That's what I've come. Because if I don't do that first, then that proves, that would say that I am not the Messiah, and that God is lying when he says that first you go to the people, the lost tribes of Israel. And he says it several times during his ministry. So Jesus, that is his aim. Today, he's having a day off from the Israelites. And this opportunity arises. And that's when he says, it wouldn't be right that I give them, and he says house dogs to the food from the table. And then she goes, ah, yes, yeah, but even house dogs can lick or can eat the scraps that fall off the master's table. She's called him Lord. The Jews didn't. She has called him Master. She has pleaded with him in mercy, asking for his mercy. This might be starting to ring some bells with some of us. And then he starts to respond by a bit of a retort. The times that we pray to God and we argue with God, we are in a battle sometimes with him in our intercessions. We are pleading for something in our life and we're just not getting the answer. We're not getting any light. We're not getting any results. This heaviness isn't lifting. Many of you would be able to identify with that, particularly if you're a woman, if you're a mother, if your daughter has been gravely ill. This reading will mean a lot to you. It will bring back perhaps some awful experiences. I have one friend in this parish at the moment whose daughter is at this point, not possessed by a devil, but possessed by an awful disease. And, you know, Monday will be a turning point for her and her family, for her daughter and her daughter's three little kids. It'll be a major turning point. And I can imagine that tonight she will be sitting in church, or tomorrow she'll be sitting in church, and she'll say, I feel like I'm the Canaanite woman. I plead and I plead and I can't seem to get any light coming into my life, lifting this burden. Not for me, this mother would be saying, the same as the Canaanite woman, the same as you may have said. Not for me. I would rather take this suffering on than have my child go through this. Some of you have probably had to say those words. That's where we're at tonight. This woman puts her own life on the line, as it were, not for herself, but to save her daughter. And then she said, we can eat the scraps, even the house dogs can eat the scraps that fall from the master's table. The master's table. She recognised that he had the ability to do this. Her faith allowed Jesus the grace to do that. He was not dealing with somebody who was pushing back. He was dealing with somebody who was coming forward with every breath that was in her body. So when we start talking about our intercessory prayer and the things that we pray for most earnestly in our life, forget the pushing back and the arguing with God because I'm not getting what I want here and now. But it is the persistence in faith that gets us across the line. God hears our prayers. We're told that he hears our prayers before they even pass our lips. He knows our needs. Do we fully trust that he has the ability to help resolve those anxieties in our life? For when we pray, it is not God reaching his hand down and doing some magical trick. When we pray, it is us who change. God never changes. It is us who change. So my ability to live with and look at this suffering at the moment, it changes. How does it change? Well, for me as a priest, one of the things I always pray for when I'm in situations like my friend I was just talking about is I pray for the doctors and the staff and the nurses who are going to be caring and who are now caring for this patient and ultimately for this family. Now, why do I pray for them? Because I can actually physically get in there and do something to support them. My intercessory prayer changes my approach to this illness. I am not a doctor. I cannot solve the illness, but I can support and help solve the anxiety that is in those who are caring. You've got parents who are anxious over their children. I can't interfere in a family's domestic affairs, but I can come in and let those families, those parents know, for example, that I am with you. You tell me what I can do and I will do my very best to achieve that for you. So my intercessory prayer as I pray for these people or I pray for the sickness is really about changing me so that I can bring my faith to strengthen their faith. As you often hear me say, it is about relationship again. And that's what's happening with this rather tragic story, and it's a little bit of a backhanded conversation that's going in there. But most of the difficult conversations we have with God, they're at that level. We're putting everything on the line when we're talking about our children or those that we love the most. We're putting everything on the line. We open ourselves up to be completely vulnerable. What have I got to lose? And this woman, in her opening up, she recognised who he was. And then he, as I said, recognised her faith. It's a very deep encounter. You would not say it's a beautiful encounter. You would not say that. This is a graphic example of the interaction between those who are in pain and those who have the ability, and our God who has the ability to remove that pain. So I just say to you, we look at all the emphasis on Gentiles today, that very often in the Gospels it is the non-elite, the non-Israelites, the chosen people. They're not. It's the ones who were not chosen that actually recognise who God is. So don't for one minute think that we're special just because we're in this church tonight and we've got our Catholic hat on and we pray our prayers this way. You pull out all stops for those that you love. Whatever works for you to get God's fullest attention. He's trying to give you his fullest attention. What are the blocks for us? For this woman, there are no blocks at all. So the table that she talks about, that table is really set by grace. It was set by grace for the Israelite people originally. But the food that was on that table that was going to be fed to the dogs, the food that is on that table, that is there for everybody and anybody who wants to make their way to that table. And that's why I'd ask you again to read the opening lines of the first reading. And that is how we should respect and invite others into coming to this table. Sure, the table was set for the Israelites, But anybody who can make their way to this table can receive that food. And some people take the tourist route, some people take the painful route.